worthy minister. Would you give credit to an enemy against the most faithful of your friends? After the death of his first wife, the emperor, at the request of the Senate, drew from her monastery Euphrosyne, the daughter of Constantine VI. Her august birth might justify a stipulation in the marriage contract that her children should equally share the empire with their elder brother. But the nuptials of Michael and Euphrosyne were barren, and she was content with the title of Mother of Theophilus, his son and successor. The Russians, who have borrowed from the Greeks the greatest part of their civil and ecclesiastical policy, preserved till the last century a singular institution in the marriage of the Tsar. They collected not the virgins of every rank and of every province, a vain and romantic idea, but the daughters of the principal nobles who awaited in the palace the choice of their sovereign. It is affirmed that a similar method was adopted in the nuptials of Theophilus. With a golden apple in his hand, he slowly walked between two lines of contending beauties. His eye was detained by the charms of Icasia, and in the awkwardness of a first declaration, the prince could only observe that, in this world, women had been the cause of much evil. "And surely, sir," she pertly replied, "they have likewise been the occasion of much good." This affectation of unseasonable wit displeased the imperial lover. He turned aside in disgust. Icasia concealed her mortification in a convent, and the modest silence of Theodora was rewarded with a golden apple. She deserved the love, but did not escape the severity of her lord. From the palace garden he beheld a vessel deeply laden and steering into the port. On the discovery that the precious cargo of Syrian luxury was the property of his wife, he condemned the ship to the flames with a sharp reproach that her avarice had degraded the character of an empress into that of a merchant. Yet his last choice entrusted her with the guardianship of the empire and her son Michael, who was left an orphan in the fifth year of his age. The restoration of images and the final extirpation of the iconoclasts has endeared her name to the devotion of the Greeks. But in the fervour of religious zeal, Theodora entertained a grateful regard for the memory and salvation of her husband. After 13 years of a prudent and frugal administration, she perceived the decline of her influence. But the second Irene imitated only the virtues of her predecessor. Instead of conspiring against the life or government of her son, she retired without a struggle, though not without a murmur, to the solitude of private life, deploring the ingratitude, the vices, and the inevitable ruin of the worthless youth. Among the successors of Nero and Elagabalus, we have not hitherto found the imitation of their vices, the character of a Roman prince who considered pleasure as the object of life, and virtue as the enemy of pleasure. Whatever might have been the maternal care of Theodora in the education of Michael III, her unfortunate son was a king before he was a man. If the ambitious mother labored to check the progress of reason, she could not cool the ebullition of passion, and her selfish policy was justly repaid by the contempt and ingratitude of the headstrong youth. At the age of 18, he rejected her authority, without feeling his own incapacity to govern the empire and himself. With Theodora, all gravity and wisdom retired from the court. Their place was supplied by the alternate dominion of vice and folly, and it was impossible, without forfeiting the public esteem, to acquire or preserve the favour of the emperor. The millions of gold and silver which had been accumulated for the service of the state were lavished on the vilest of men, who flattered his passions and shared his pleasures. And in a reign of 13 years, the richest of sovereigns was compelled to strip the palace and the churches of their precious furniture. Like Nero, he delighted in the amusements of the theatre, and sighed to be surpassed in the accomplishments in which he should have blushed to excel. Yet the studies of Nero in music and poetry betrayed some symptoms of a liberal taste. The more ignoble arts of the son of Theophilus were confined to the chariot race of the Hippodrome. The four factions which had agitated the peace still amused the idleness of the capital. For himself, the emperor assumed the blue livery. The three rival colours were distributed to his favourites, and in the vile, though eager contention, he forgot the dignity